figure out what's working in the movement as far as advocacy organizations are concerned, and she's done a lot of work in that area. I will, before you get started, Erin, just remind everybody that we are recording the session. We will let Erin speak, and then once she gets done, we will turn it over to a Q&A mode. And at that point, you just want to be careful if you don't want yourself identified on a recording. Just be aware of that, not to say names and that kind of thing. So, Erin, I'm going to turn it over to you. If you'd like to introduce yourself any further, you can take it from here.
All right. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Again, as Jennifer said, my name is Erin Comartin, and I am an assistant professor at Oakland University in Michigan. How I came to try to research this topic was that I actually was a MSW intern in my master's program, and I came across a group of advocates in the state of Michigan that were working on this issue, and I knew very little. I believed in all the myths that our society tells us about registered individuals and sex offenders, and when these women challenged me because they had experienced having a family member placed on the registry, it kind of opened my eyes to what we're doing incorrectly, I believe, on this crime policy. So I worked with them in the capital of Michigan in Lansing to just kind of understand how the policy environment worked in Michigan, but also to see how they worked with legislators and key decision makers to bring about change in the state of Michigan. And as I learned and I grew, I started trying to figure out if there are other groups across the nation doing similar things in other states, and lo and behold, I found the RSOL website. So that's kind of how I came to this. I started working with a group in Michigan in 2005, so I've been around for some time, not quite as long as most of the advocates out there have been, but I really am interested and feel honored to work with all the groups across the nation trying to bring about this change. So I know that I'm here to kind of present to you, but I'm presenting to you about you. So I'm not the expert here. Definitely all of you sitting on the call or on your computers right now are really the experts on this. But what I see my role as is taking a long-term view at your organization and trying to help inform what you're doing. So reflecting on research from other social movements, trying to change other types of laws, and how this movement can use that information. So having said that, it's a little bit about me. But again, I definitely don't think I'm the expert here. I'm a little nervous because I feel like I'm presenting to the experts. So I'll just get started, though. So I started the first round of interviews for my first study in 2011. And right now, I'm in the middle of doing a second round of interviews with the groups that were previously in the study in 2011. And I'm adding new groups as we speak right now, because my goal here is to do another round of interviews in 2019 to write a book. And what we know about policy change through the advocates' perspective is that on average it takes 10 years to bring about any significant type of change. So had I done this one set of interviews in 2011, it wouldn't have told us a whole lot. It was just a snapshot in time. So what I'm most interested in is seeing how organizations change over time as an organization, but how the advocates change the way they message and change the strategies that they use to bring about change. So right now I'm still in the middle of doing telephone interviews, so I'm going to present some preliminary results from the interviews that I've been doing this summer and I'm going to continue to do, but I have not full-on analyze that data. So I know that there are some changes happening, but I can't speak to them all at this point. I'm really hoping that by around 2020, I'll have lots of information and seeing how people have changed, crafted their message and changed their strategies and achieved more policy outcomes by that time. So just to know where I'm heading with this. So how I started off the study and what I'm looking at is I looked at important components of other movements that and have tried to apply it to the sex offender registration and notification movement. I know that seemed kind of limited because we know that there's a lot more about being a registered individual and a registered family than just the registry, but that's really kind of where all this pans out from. So that's why I call it this movement. In the research literature, there are four areas that all social movement organizations are analyzed from. The first is messaging. The second is the capacity of an organization to bring about change through structure, their organizational structure and resources. The third is the strategies they take on to bring about change, either through the courts, through lobbying and advocacy, public education. I'll talk more about those later. And then finally, the ultimate goal is what impact do they actually have on policy? So those are the policy outcomes. So I'll be talking about these individually. So first is messaging. I'm not going to bore you with tons of research detail about what messaging means and all the information other researchers have provided. I'm just going to kind of make it, you know, kind of quick snippets. But we do know that how movements frame their position greatly influences the outcomes that they can achieve. So not that they have overarching messages that they use all the time, but that they actually tailor the message to different people. Tailoring can be to the members of the organization, to politicians and government bureaucrats, can be to the general public at large. But ultimately, what tailoring comes down to is getting very specific information about the individual person that you're trying to persuade and using their lingo, their values to change their beliefs, to kind of side with you and agree with you about what you're arguing for, what you're asking for from a decision maker. So, you know, more specifically, you're going to tailor your message differently if you're trying to talk to someone in law enforcement about this issue than if you're trying to talk to somebody who's a treatment provider. They have different lingos, generally different values. So it's getting down to that specific narrow level of tailoring a message. There are three levels of tailoring. The first is for the cause. So this is kind of has the underpinnings of the mission of the group or the mission of the movement and how you just get basic information out about policy. The second is the tailoring of the message that I was just talking about on the last slide. So that's for mobilization. And then the last is messaging as a reaction to people who want to see something different and opposing than what you want to see change. So I'm going to talk about these. First, for this movement now specifically, when I applied this way of viewing messaging to this movement in the interviews that I did back in 2011 with 19 organizational leaders, all of the message for the cause and the mission boiled down to these 5 points. Almost everyone had one or more of these as their basic points of argument when they're talking about the unfairness or inequity of registering individuals. The first was they educate the public and policymakers about research that refutes the assumptions that underlie registration policies. Next is that we are all concerned about safety, so that we need to take a different approach to actually keep people safe from sexual violence. The third is that there are different types of registered individuals and not all should be treated as violent predators. So kind of, you know, making a point that who you see on the registry is not all-encompassing. They're not all one type of offender. They're very different types of offenders that are listed. The fourth argument is the constitutional rights of offenders that court cases are based off of, so, you know, ex post facto laws and things like that. And the last is the unintended consequences that come from being a registered individual, both for the registrant and the people that they live with. So when you want to tailor that message for mobilization, it's picking apart which one of those arguments fits best for the people you're talking with. So what I found with the 19 groups in 2011 is that when they were talking to people in the public, the more groups focus on the myths under the law, about low recidivism rates and stranger danger being the underlying or high recidivism rates and stranger danger being the underlying reasons for these laws, but those aren't the major cases of these crimes or of the people on the registry. They also talked about the cost to the public to maintain and monitor individuals on the registry. And then the last was the impact that this had on children. When people were messaging to policymakers and key decision makers, the majority of the organizations talked about the cost to policymakers. And that speaks to the political environment we find ourselves in 2011, especially so close to the recession. So that was a key argument to sway some politicians to hear the organization out and hear the message that they were trying to get across. The second point was that, again, the laws are ineffective and they're not keeping people safe. And the last major point that groups were using were about the impacts on family members of individuals on the registry. On the slide, for people who've called in and can't see the slide, I just want to let you know that there's a quote that I have here from one of the advocates that I want to read to you because it spoke to some of the points that the advocates were making. When we talk to the general public, we emphasize how smarter criminal laws would make them safer at less cost. We don't talk about the rights of the bad people they are scared of, or not as much. The message, your rights are in danger if you let anybody's rights be trampled on, doesn't resonate the same way as we can make you safer for less money. And I see that is something that some of in these new interviews that I've been doing in 2015, that it seems a couple of the organizations have shifted away from the collateral consequences arguments and more to the safety and the cost. So that seems to be some shift that I've noticed recently. The last messaging area is as a reaction to challengers. So this is for people who might show up at testimony or people who might advocate against what SOR organizations are trying to say. I have picked up on this in that this is a change. It seems to me in 2011 there were 9 organizations that reported having a challenger. In 2015, over the summer, for the interviews I've done so far, it really seems like there are a lower number of groups reporting having challengers when they go testify or having vehement challenging by politicians. It seems like the walls are starting to come down. I can't say for sure at this point because I haven't analyzed all the data, but it seems like this is one area of change I've noticed. So, of course, if you're reacting to a challenger, you need to, one, understand what they're saying, and then try and create a counterpoint argument to their cause. So what most of the people who had challengers in 2011 were finding is that the arguments their challengers were saying was that children and families need protection. And that sometimes the challenger was a government organization that didn't want to lose burn funding. And this was, again, around the time when a lot of states were talking about Adam Walsh Act compliance. So they were afraid of losing burn funding. And that was a major kind of argument, that they show up to testify, and the only person testifying against the organization was a law enforcement agency, and it was about loss of funding. And then finally, the other main frame that a challenger presented was the kind of last line of some of the harshest arguments or discussions that you find yourself in is that at the end of the day, this population deserves the sanction. So when I asked the advocates about these frames of the challenger, I said, well, what do you say, in response to them? And it boiled down to, using the research evidence that shows the laws are not effective at protecting families. Shows the high cost that some states have done, the research behind some of the states that have shown that the burn funding that came with Adam Walsh Act compliance does not give enough money to a state to actually fully implement it. And then at the end of the day, and this is normally came with the offender, with the challenger saying that offenders deserve the sanction, is ignoring them. At that point, it's kind of a no-win argument. So this is something that I think is an issue that in some states needs to be overcome, but I just, at this point, don't have a solution to that. So overall about messaging is that there's three end goals with the messages by the groups I talked to in 2011, is that you're appealing to either people's logic, to their hearts, but to their sense of values on a national level. So the logic is through the rational research-based arguments. The hearts of the public is generally about discussing collateral consequences for family members specifically and young offenders on the list. And the last is about the rights arguments of the constitutional rights. Most organizations in 2011 tailored their messages, and it was, you know, the major takeaway point for me was that if you're talking to a policymaker, you talk about the cost, and if you're talking to the public, you talk around the myths about the population and the impact on families. What was clear to me is that the organizations that took a more proactive approach, and that means the organizations that had actually been involved with developing a positive policy for the movement, they were generally the ones that discussed with me the most about tailoring down to the individual elected official, either by their party membership or by their previous employment history. You know, knowing before you go to a politician that their previous work history was in law enforcement, they would create their arguments around the values that generally can be assigned to that population. Or going to their webpage and finding out about their families and finding out more about their district and how many registrants are there. So it was really getting down to very specific things about the person they were trying to persuade. Okay, so what I have here on this slide is now we're moving to the organizations themselves. So this is the first column on the left of the chart that you're looking at, for those who can see it. And so this is the structure and resources of the organization. The other three categories or columns on this chart are the strategies to bring about change that I investigated. What were people using in the political or legal arenas to try and sway people to bring about an eventual policy outcome? And that's the last column on the right. So blocking a policy, getting a placement on the policy agenda, developing a policy, all of those. So the first column is what I'm going to go into now. And this is just getting a general overview. Since this is my first time interviewing many of these groups, I wanted to know when the group started, why it was started, how many key players started it. So just a general history. Then the next two under capacity are the knowledge and skills that advocacy organizations need to have to do effective messaging and effectively strategize to bring about a policy outcome. Again, this is drawn from research about other social movements, and I tailored it to this specific movement to ask the groups, you know, where do they feel they have strong knowledge and skills, and where do they feel like they could get some beefing of information and training. And the last three there are talking about the structure and the hierarchy and decision making of the group, the resources that they have, generally members and finances, and then more specific boiling down to the membership. I'm going to talk about those now, the capacity. So structure and resources, most often the research literature about social movement organizations talks about how bringing together a group of rational people to use their resources effectively and efficiently to bring about change is good for any movement. So, because it brings legitimacy and credibility to the group and the cause. So organizations cannot help but become more structured as they grow and mobilize is the general finding from this area of research, is that a group is well-meaning, they start to build a structure and a hierarchy, they have a board, they make all these, you know, structured decisions, and then that becomes part of the process, is maintaining the organization itself. And that while that sometimes brings legitimacy, and the research has shown that this legitimacy comes resources, and these resources are supposed to lead to greater outcomes. Now, in most cases, this is what I found in the interviews in 2011, but there was a couple organizations that really raised this as an issue, and they said that for some states, going to the level of legitimacy to build a hierarchy, a board, write yearly reports for annual reports for the government because they're incorporated, just became too overburdening, and that they felt like they would be spending too much time on maintaining the structure of the organization than they could dedicate themselves to doing the actual advocacy work. So there were a couple groups that had rumblings of that in 2011, and actually this is another area in 2015 where I found that some groups started out, again, having an organization, but then finding that that was too cumbersome and pulling back and deciding not to go that route. So it seems to be another shift I'm seeing over time. I don't want to go over this next slide too much, but this is just a slide I pulled from the interviews I did in 2011 that showed some of these elements of a formalized structure. So looking at the hierarchy and the use of resources through subcommittees and decision-making by members or just the board if they had one, and the different types of documents that can be a sign that there's some formalization going on. So many of the groups, all of the groups had an identified leader, 11 had had an executive board, and 12 had been incorporated. So those are generally the earlier signs that there is a group forming and an organization forming. But again, this I'll need to update for with the 2015 interviews. The resources of the organizations, history here is that the organizations began between 2006 and 2011. Because the impact on registrants and family members was the major reason that the organizations were started, this group in the types of social movement organizations in the research literature is really what is called an identity-driven movement. And while when we talk about the issue of being labeled a sex offender as a negative identity, in this case on an organizational level, it seems that this may be a positive thing in that identity-driven movements generally garner high commitment levels from the members who are involved. And what has been shown is that when there's this high level of commitment over the long haul, that all the other resources don't matter all that much. So level of finances, total membership, all of those other things can kind of fall away if there are people who are truly, truly passionate about what they're doing and truly want to see long-term outcomes. So again, while the identity assigned to this group is generally not a positive thing, this may work well for the movement as a whole. So other resources that I looked at was asking about annual budgets. Only six in 2011 reported having an annual budget. Most of them were $5,000 or less. A couple were higher than that, but not too many. I also asked about how many total members. This could have been, you know, people on an email listserv or mailing list that just received the information about the organization. And on average, there was 110 in the state, and they ranged anywhere from one member to 500 members. And then the active members were those who were doing the real work of the organization by implementing the strategies to bring about a policy change. So on average, most groups had 15 active members and anywhere between 1 and 230 active members. The other thing around membership that I'd like to talk about is the inclusion of members who have a professional membership. So they're not individuals who have personally been affected by these laws, such as a registrant themselves or their family members, but this is somebody who may come to the group as a therapist or a probation officer or a judge or an attorney. So these are people who are just professionally associated with this issue. In 2011, three out of every four individuals that I interviewed had at least one professional member. And in 2015, recent shift that I've picked up on is that some of the groups have built strong coalitions and networks with other professional advocacy organizations like the ACLU or APSA, but they've found that sometimes they don't have their voices heard as much as those organizations. So they're starting to move away and not be so dependent or so connected with the other organizations. So that's a recent shift that I've seen. But again, the pictures that I have there are the groups, the two organizations that most often are a collaborator with SORNA groups, so the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, or the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, APSA. So some states have strong collaborations with them, some have loose, some are non-existent, but those were the two that generally got reported the most. Other types of professional members that could have been involved are legal. So this most often was a defense attorney who took on cases at the same time that they might have been providing testimony for bad bills. Next were treatment providers. Then there were researchers working on this issue, like myself. Some organizations actually had a victims' rights group or movement within the state at the table, so someone that they could agree upon what was good policy and what was bad policy to ultimately achieve a reduction in sexual violence rates in the state. Other types of professional members included police, parole, or probation. Some states also had members of the clergy or the business community on board as well. So now that was the capacity, so the resources and structure of the organization. Now I'm going to talk about the strategies to bring about policy change. So again, I drew from research literature about other movements and the strategies that they use. But what this really boils down to is analyzing power. Who are the key decision makers in the state around criminal justice, most often criminal justice policy, and what can you do as a group or as an individual to persuade them to see your side of it and help you make change? And then, again, these can come from either in the political realm in the state capital, or it can come through suing, doing litigation advocacy, is what that is called. So different points in the policy process call for different types of advocacy strategies. If you're trying to block a bad bill, the most often used policy is testimony, or doing research around the policy, doing policy analysis, and also lobbying and doing policymaker education. Those seem to be the three that are most often reported when a group is trying to block a bill. But other strategies start getting used when you're trying to get your issue put on the policy agenda that is being discussed amongst politicians to maybe bring up as an issue, or when you're developing a policy, or when you're helping the policy that was developed go through the process of becoming law. So different strategies get used for those outcomes. The key here is that no matter what one is trying to do in the political environment, no matter what the organization is trying to do, is that research tells us the strategies must be flexible. Historically, anything you know about politics and research is that everything changes so fast. And one day something can be very important, and then the media picks up on something else, and you never discuss that issue anymore. So there's always got to be advocates ready to be able to adapt to the political environment. What this takes, ultimately, is a lot of resources, because it calls for advocates to have quick access to their state legislatures, have someone, having a public face for key decision makers where they always see them around, and having the skill to know when to use different strategies depending on the shifting environment. So in order to do that, advocates have to get really nuanced in their approach to taking advantage of opportunities. And these opportunities generally in this movement find themselves through media stories. And as you can see on the slide, I have Zach Anderson and his father, their pictures there, because this was a case that got national attention, happened on the border of Michigan and Indiana. And it's one where people could tap into the irrationality behind this law and see what was being done. So using these types of media stories that come up to the group's advantage to try and sway and message and frame and craft their message. Other advantages are court decisions. So when there's an appellate or district or state Supreme Court case that says there are components of these laws that are unconstitutional, and bringing that to the attention of the legislators, because it can take anywhere between 2 and 16 years for a state legislator to respond to an unconstitutional court case. There's people advocating for a response to change the law, and there's people bringing that more to their attention, then it's more likely for it to pass. But sometimes they just sit and wait and don't have any movement. Other advantages are just looking at the internal workings of politicians in the state. So this is knowing who gets along with whom, knowing who can work across the aisle with whom, knowing how just the processes in how a bill becomes a law in the state can take time. So a major one is I just became aware of something in Michigan that I had no idea was had to happen, is that an individual legislator can only propose a certain number of bills every year. So they have to use them wisely because they can't just introduce as many bills as they want, and they can't be a co-sponsor, lead sponsor on as many bills as they want. They have to use them judiciously. So knowing those things and how to help them around those issues is also, you know, taking advantage of an opportunity that might present itself in the environment. So looking at my 2011 interviews, what you'll see here is on the left side is the strategies that were reported that the groups had used. So clearly, most of these should not come as a surprise, is lobbying and policymaker education, research and policy analysis, testimony, legal advocacy and litigation, networking and coalition building, the use of media stories and using the media to get your message out and doing interviews, grassroots organizing and mobilization with your membership, and using electronic media as a form of outreach to gain new members or to get your message out. Other strategies that other social movements use that I did not find any organization reporting that they had used were polling the public about their opinions about the registry, going out and doing voter education campaigns. Public education was used, but not to the level as the other policies that I just listed. Demonstration projects or pilot programs, endorsements of political candidates, and rallies or marches. And what you're seeing here in looking at these two lists is that because of the stigma associated with this issue, most of the organizations don't use the strategies that will bring a lot of public attention that could be outside of the control of the organization. So the idea here, and especially in some of the states that have had kind of a seat at the table for a while, is that the legislator is going to stick their neck out and help this cause. They need to get some protection from the organization so that all of the public won't find out that, quote unquote, they're being light on sex offenders, because they know that that is political suicide for them. So they can't have a large, boisterous movement because they can't stick their neck out. So that's really what you see with the strategies that are being used. Here on this next slide is strategy flexibility. So this is what I was talking about, how the political environment changes so quickly that you have to be ready to adapt to that change. And what I found were that some of the groups said they were flexible to the environment and they changed their strategies very rarely. So in 2011, it didn't seem like these changes were happening as often as what has been found in other social movements. So some people shifted their dominant overall strategy. Some changed the way they frame the issues, and some used negotiation skills with policy key decision makers to say, okay, well, we won't push this issue if you'll help us on this issue. So that was being flexible to what was going on in the political environment. Others were flexible in that they just kind of learned lessons as they became more savvy in the political environment. So I call these growing pains, right? So they changed the way they testified, you know, assigning people the points that needed to be made so that everybody wasn't repeating the same thing. Some groups actually changed their goals. You know, I think some of you might recognize this in your own groups where you think you're going to start an organization, you're going to start an advocacy effort, and you think it's going to take 2 years. But what we know, and what many of you know, is that this is for the long haul. Trying to do away with or really make registration laws effective takes a lot of time because there's a lot of barriers that need to be jumped over in order to do so. And ultimately, some groups learned that they need to delay the policy they wanted to implement for a time when it would be likely to pass. And this generally came with a legislator telling them this, giving them this feedback, saying, I know this is what you want, but this is really, you got to save it for a time when this environment is more open to it. But there are these smaller things coming up that you could do. And so using all the resources and capacity of the group to focus on what is most likely to happen rather than focusing on what they want to happen. And here are the opportunities that I just briefly discussed that some of the organizations were using back in 2011. So the opportunities in the legislature was finding one legislator that they had a strong collaboration with that would truly wanted to help, and using their networks in the state capitol to sway more people to the side. Another issue in the legislature was when allies had control over what bills were being heard in committee, and having those allies push the bill, the bad bill, to the end of the pile so that it wouldn't be heard before the session closed. So that's using the connections and networks they've made to kind of achieve the ultimate goals that they wanted. A few of the groups actually use media representations of cases of individuals on the registry. Most often these were the Romeo and Juliet cases. And another one was the case of false accusation. I believe it was the lacrosse team at Duke University. This one got used by a couple of groups to make the point that there are issues with the law around false accusations. And sometimes that would garner some swaying of political decision makers. And then last is some of the organizations actually did use the courts, court decisions that found components of the registry and notification as unconstitutional. So this was advantageous to a couple of the groups, is saying, hey, this is the courts have found this, so the legislature needs to adapt to it and change the law and amend the law. So what I've seen here too is really interesting. In a couple of interviews in 2015 that I've done this summer, some groups are no longer focusing on the actual politicians themselves. You know, as we know with the changing of our laws and how money gets funneled to politicians for their campaigns, we are starting to understand that most often legislators are not the most powerful decision makers. It is their lobbyists, the lobbyists who pay for their campaigns. So now some people got pretty sophisticated in their advocacy efforts by getting close with lobbyists that are close to certain members on judiciary committees or are close to other members that have lots of political power to try and amend the law. So that was a key shift I saw this summer. So now we're finally at the policy outcomes. So what did the groups report to me that they thought were their most successful outcomes? At the time in 2011, only 16 of the 19 individuals I interviewed felt that they had actually achieved a policy outcome, and they were around these four types of policy outcomes. 7 groups had successfully blocked a bad policy. 3 groups made amendments to laws related to registration. And then 5 were in the process of working with legislators to develop a policy. And 1 group had actually gotten to the point where the policy that they had worked to develop with the legislator had been adopted and passed into law. So my inkling now in 2015 is that the groups are getting some more successes in their states. Most of them are still blocking bad bills, but some of them are moving on to develop and amend bills that are currently of issue. But what I found in 2015, and I think this is a big success, I don't know if everyone else will agree with me, but 2 organizations that I've interviewed this summer reported that historically, they've had lots of bad bills introduced in their state legislatures, but in the most recent session, no new negative bills related to sex offenders had been introduced. And because normally there are many, many bad bills in state legislatures, you know, being introduced time and time again in one session, the fact that no bills in 2 state legislatures had been introduced was very surprising to me. So that seems to me a sign of success. It's a minor success, but I think it's a big success. It's not, it's not developing good policy, but as long as we can slow the tide, I think that's a good thing. And I can't talk about all the work that you as advocates are doing unless I talk about the role that stigma plays with this issue. I brought it up a couple times, but stigma is clearly a sizable challenge to this movement. We know that there are lots of myths and perceptions about this population that research doesn't uphold, but the public believes because of the way we frame this issue, mostly since the 1970s. So advocates do not use contentious or unruly strategies. These are more like rallies and marches to bring the attention to this issue, because again, there needs to be some political protection for legislators who are going to try and help the movement. The stigma associated, I found, was a cause for barriers for the organization to attain legitimacy in the state and also to bring members into the group and get access to other resources to achieve their goals. What most of the group said is that they found that when they had professional members doing the work with them, it increased the legitimacy of the cause. So bringing an attorney or a treatment provider or a judge with you to advocate, to talk about the research side of the issue and the problems with these laws brought the group more esteem in the eyes of political decision makers. Some organizations also said that to overcome the stigma associated with the population in general, they had to use the cases that were most sympathetic to kind of call attention to the issue. So this is like the Zach Anderson case or the Romeo and Juliet law. So it's starting with the cases that brought the most sympathy in order to open the door to the bigger issues involved with the law. So the takeaway points that I have for this movement at this time, and again, I really hope that I have a lot more once you know my 10 years of doing this research turns into a bigger research study. But at this point, you know, again, research is slow on this topic. It takes 10 years to make significant policy change. Again, that's why I'm looking at this for 10 years or more. And even after the book, I plan to follow this because this is, you know, how I got started in my research career. That's something that's very important to me. But, you know, many people in the movement burn out and they get to this point where they just can't do it anymore because it's so much work. It's an uphill battle. But I think if you keep this kind of in mind that it doesn't matter what movement you're in, it still takes 10 years to make significant policy change. I think that is something to kind of keep in mind to keep the energy going. I know it's difficult, but this is something that you need to get into for the long haul. It's not gonna be of short duration. Another takeaway point about building an advocacy group is that different states have different political environments. So to say that to start a group, you have to register with the IRS, you have to, you know, bring legitimacy through having professional members, it would be completely wrong for me to say, because in some states, you need the organization for legitimacy because the politicians call for it, because they're more skeptical or they're less likely to be open to the issue. In other states, it may be one really good advocate that has strong skills of persuasion, that has a very prominent face around the Capitol that could do the work. So to say that there's one best way of doing this work is would be incorrect. So it's really learning about the state, its political environment, and what is going to be the most effective messaging, resources, and strategies to bring about the change. States where advocates are one voice amongst many generally need the bigger show. So they need to focus on building the organization, building the membership, bringing in money, really solidly crafting their message. And the last point is maneuvering. I kind of use that to say that if there's lots of advocates and lots of issues going on at the state capitol, you need all of these things, money, members, and messaging, but you also really need to know what strategies to use when, depending on the ever-changing political environment. It's really complex, and it takes a while to learn these skills and to have the finesse to know what is the most appropriate approach at any given time. So impacting change ultimately for this movement, what I have found so far is that successful policy maker education and lobbying takes, again, time in the long term, but time on a day-to-day level. So being, you know, it's not that you have to be at the state capitol or in their offices every day, but having a consistent presence. So maybe that's once a quarter or once a session, depending on how often your legislature meets. But you can't do this one time and expect them to remember you, right? So they need to build. You need to build rapport with them in a trusting relationship in order for them to really step up and do something for the movement. The other areas that I've seen that have been impacting change on these policies is having a strong understanding of the laws and their assumptions behind them that created the law, and also knowing how the law impacts victims, impacts registrants, and impacts the community are all very important things to know and to be able to communicate to individuals to persuade them to hear what the organizations are trying to say. And successful, you know, impacting change also is heavily reliant on the messaging that the organization uses and how they tailor that message, and ultimately what strategies they use to bring about change. The last part here about impacting change is one that only a few organizations had when I talked to them in 2011. Again, in 2015, seeing a change here, it seems like more of the groups have an alternative policy ready to go. So what that means is that the idea here is that these laws, registration laws and notification laws and the many laws that come out from there, are ultimately designed to have an impact on reducing rates of sexual violence. So if you're going to go to a legislator and continually say, these laws are bad, these laws are bad, these laws are bad, that doesn't help a politician. They want to know what is good. So if this isn't going to solve the problem, what is going to solve the problem? So having a well-articulated alternative policy that you can compare to the impact that registration has on the community, and saying and being able to argue that this alternative policy is better than what we have now in registration laws is key to bringing about change. Because policymakers hear a lot about what's wrong, and they don't get a lot about what's right. And when something is done for them and researched and crafted for them from the group, it makes their job easier. And they're more likely to pick up the issue if that is ready to go for them. So that's the study so far. I'm going to do a shameless plug here in that I'm still looking for advocates in the States on the screen for my interviews this time. I'm trying to include as many groups as possible so I can tell a true story of this movement as a whole. So I'm looking for people from Connecticut, Illinois, Maine, Mississippi, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Oregon, South Carolina, Vermont, and Washington. So if anyone in the group is interested, looking for people who are, you know, intimately involved in the group on a leadership level, if that's what the group, how the group is designed by hierarchy, I would like to hear more so that I can make a really strong case when I go to analyze all this information over 10 years. So ultimately, the more the merrier. And that is all I have, and I will open it up for questions.
Okay, thank you, Erin. We can do a Q&A now. If you are online or on your phone, I think, you can hit *6. There's a little keypad if you're on your computer. That will put you in the queue for Q&A and to ask Erin anything. Brenda, I've taken you off the mute as well if you would like to say anything or respond to any questions. I would just say that, Erin, I really appreciate your presentation and your research. This is Jennifer in Kentucky, and I've been involved with RSOL and around these issues for quite some time now, and it's encouraging to me to hear your research, just as I feel like we've come a long way. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Yeah, and are you hearing me okay?
Yep.
Yes.
Great. Just making sure I hadn't muted myself separately. This is Brenda with RSOL in Maryland, and I've already responded to all your questionnaires, so I know how much work it takes to have done the study that you did. Erin does fairly lengthy interview, records it all, transcribes it all, shares it back with the person that she interviewed, and makes sure that she captured what we really said, and we can fill in any gaps that we forgot about or something. So it's a massive, massive undertaking, and we're really grateful that she's been involved with that and is having the opportunity to share it. And I look forward to hearing more about the research even at the 2015 point and eventually that final round. What year was that again?
2019.
19, yeah.
But I don't even know if I'd call that the final round. I mean, I think I'm right. in this for the long haul, too, but that's...
Well,
just, I'm hoping
the final for when you do your book.
Right. For the 10 years. I'm holding up for, 10 years for significant policy change. That's right around 10 years, so...
Right, right. But, a lot of good stuff there, and I've had a lot of people listening in, so... Star 6, if anyone has a question, please remember that we want to keep your questions brief and try to keep your questions on point. Something to do with what Aaron is presenting as opposed to some personal question or other. I believe at this point, Jennifer,
I don't see anybody in the queue, but we did have one question on the chat, Aaron. It says, have the 2011 results been published, and will the 2015 results, the information you're getting now, be published at some point, or are you just planning to write a book later?
Actually, a publication just came out in the Journal of Policy Practice, which summarize the strategies and the outcomes, the policy outcomes from the 2011 data. So that was published, I think, 2 or 3 months ago.
I thought I had seen something go by, and then I couldn't find it again. I was going to try to post it up on our
Oh, I can send it to you. They actually, this journal allows me to share 50 copies, so I can send that to you.
Oh, wonderful.
Yep.
Yeah. Sometimes that can get expensive, those things.
Yeah, it's no joke.
We do have one in the queue now. So
okay.
You're up.
Hello. I heard somebody say hello, but now they're not speaking.
Well, if I can also answer, unless the person pops back up, but the... there's also, I'm working on one just about the messaging in association with the stigma that the leaders talked about. So that's what I'm planning to have under review at a journal by December. And then from there, it's just working towards the book. So I don't intend to produce something solely off the 2015 data.
Yeah, okay. One thing that I don't know if this is too big of a question, Aaron, but we actually tend to have a lot of folks on these calls who are actually fairly new advocates in their state. They may or may not be a part of a group, and they may be actually thinking of getting one started. So is there any advice or history or anything else specifically for them that you might want to share? If somebody said, hey, I'm just getting started in my state, anything that you'd like to recommend to folks?
Yeah, I really do think the national office is obviously a great place to start. You guys have been in this fight for a while, and you're putting on these trainings and discussions, and you help kind of groups get off the ground. And so I think that is really important for new advocates. But I think that just walking into this movement is daunting, especially if you're a personally affected individual, because you've got all the personal issues, the personal things that come along with having to be a part of this movement, but you're also trying to figure out how to bring about change in a very complex arena. But I think the first place to start is really crafting your message, knowing what you want to say, and knowing how you need to deliver that message. And I think what I've noticed, and what a lot of the advocates have said to me in interviews, is that when new members come aboard, it takes quite a bit of time to help them remove their emotions from the messaging. Because this is daunting to families and daunting to registrants on what they get put through under the policies. So rightly so, that they're quite emotional, whether that's angry or sad. But in the political arena, when you're trying to change laws, those emotions have to be really reined in. So it's almost practicing the message time and time again so that the removal of that emotion doesn't stunt your growth and doesn't stunt the message, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I would agree with that, Erin, that most, I know when my group got started and the first few times that we were making presentations, it was a little more about us and a little less about whatever the policy was that we were trying to change, you know, doing testimony.
Right.
But we kind of picked up that while people came up to us and patted us on our shoulder and told us how brave we weren't changing the policy. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we spent a little time analyzing the bill a little more and, you know, and actually came in and were focused on that and avoided a lot of personal story and personal emotion, not exclusively, but, mm-hmm. you know, most of the time, it definitely had more impact. So I would agree with you on that.
Okay. We have a couple in the queue here. Our first one has an area code 720. You've been holding there for just as we went through that question that Brenda had. So go ahead.
This is Susan Walker from Denver.
Hi.
my question is, you were mentioning there are states where you haven't been able to interview anybody, and some of the states that I heard you mention do have fairly prominent contacts in some of those states.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that you haven't talked to anybody is because people didn't want to talk to you, or you haven't found anybody in those states, or...
It could be a little bit of both. This was kind of my last final plug to try. Some of the emails I was provided bounced back. So I don't know if I just have a wrong email address, but I thought in the event that someone was on this call and wanted to participate, I would put it out there.
Okay.
So many of those
contacts. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. We can definitely get you contacts for our organization in several of those states.
Right.
Yeah.
So some of it is, many of those states I mentioned were not part of my study last time. So the last time I did the study, I went to the conference in St. Louis first to try and get to know people and put faces with names and do some preliminary questions. And then I did the study, and then I went back to the conference in New Mexico and presented the results of the 2011 study. And that was great, but many of those, the states I had mentioned, were not around at that time. So some of these are the newer states. Not all of them that I listed, but some of them are the newer RSOL groups. And I probably should also mention that not everyone in my study in 2011 was a part of RSOL. There's some states, I think I had 3 or 4 states that were non-RSOL members.
Yeah. Yeah, and we certainly don't have the corner on the market there.
So, yeah. We are close to the corner on the market.
Thanks, Erin.
You're welcome.
Anybody else, Jennifer?
Yeah, we've got one more.
Okay.
Good evening, Erin. This is Richard Earle in New Hampshire.
Okay.
I actually am almost going to be embarrassed in asking this question because I'm afraid I don't know the answer, and it could embarrass us here in New Hampshire. But did you talk to New Hampshire CCJR?
I actually, by research criteria, I'm not allowed to disclose that because when I do my research studies, I provide anonymity.
Oh.
So,
I'll have to ask Bob.
Yeah, you have to ask around.
let me offer this. If you're still doing your study and you have not talked to CCJR, I would encourage you to get in touch with us because I do think we would speak with you.
Okay, great. I will. I'll get with Brenda to get your email address.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you.
I if I could have more of those appeals, that would be great.
Yep. Yeah, I'll definitely get with Erin and make sure she has our most recent contacts. Again, some of them are, as you pointed out, are organizations of one, and then but there are some others that are, you know, larger, and we have up to date info on.
Great.
So.
Great.
Yeah. Yep.
Aaron, somebody asked about said they know some of the folks that are associated with Oregon Voices, and wanted to know your contact information so that they could pass that on.
Okay, I will bring it up. It's on the screen now, and then I'll also type it in the well, if you're on the chat, you can see the screen. So it's, my last name is Comartin at oakland.edu. And I'll also type in my phone number, which is 248-370-2425.
And for those who may be just listening, that's Comartin is spelled C-O-M as in mother, A-R-T-I-N as in never, at Oakland, O-A-K-L-A-N-D dot E-D-U.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
We don't have anybody else in the queue right now.
All right. Last chance. It's a star six. And if anybody has any other questions for Aaron.
I don't see any.
All right.
All right.
Wait a minute. Somebody came on. Let's see.
Okay. You figured out how to press star six. Very good.
Richard, is that you again?
It is me again. Since no one's asking questions, and I hope this isn't a problem, Brenda, could we maybe find out if there are anybody from Pennsylvania on this call tonight?
Yes. I won't know, but I think I know where you're going with this. What
yes.
I will do is, as we move toward closing, just let folks know that I'm going to be at a conference in Pennsylvania on Saturday. I'll be at a booth along with a couple of other board members, and we're encouraging folks to, if you're in Pennsylvania or New Jersey, because we're in, if you've got that information, Richard, maybe you can say it.
You're in Westchester County, which is eastern Pennsylvania. Outside of Philadelphia.
Eastern Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. But what, half an hour, 40 minutes maybe outside of Philadelphia?
Yeah.
Downtown anywhere? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be there most of the day, and then anybody that would like to get together, you're welcome to come to, it's Bars, Barriers, or Justice is the name of the conference put on by DEFCAN, Pennsylvania. That's deaf as in non-speaking, C-A-N, .org, and the Pennsylvania group. They're going to be there that day. And since I'll be up there, it would be an opportunity for anybody who's in the area, if they'd like to get together over dinner, we're going to try to see if we can arrange to go to a local restaurant, still under discussion as to exactly where. But you know, about 5:30-ish there in Westchester. So stay tuned. If you're a member, you'll get an invitation maybe today or tomorrow. Just to put it on your calendar and see if you can come out.
It looks like we have one other person in the queue.
Okay.
Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sure can.
Yeah. I'm David in Florida. I'm a member of the Program Action Committee. And I have a question. Litigation and legislation. There's only so much money to go around.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, in your opinion, is the best avenue to go first?
Well, in framing that as... there's only so much money to go around. You know, we know that the least costly of those two strategies is generally the legislation.
Okay.
But it's also more time on the part of the advocates. So right. if there,
but
if
you you understand what's going on out here in Florida.
I do. And what is generally, I would say, is the first approach, especially for new groups, is to try the legislative avenue. And then when and when those doors close, or there's not a movement quick enough, and the resources are available for litigation, I would say go that road. And there are some states that have done that. They've tried, and the political environment and politicians just are not willing to do anything. So the last resort is when that arm of the government does not want to follow the, you know, the Constitution, the route to take is through the court system. So I always say, if you can bring about change in any type of contentious policy, the best way to bring out long-term cultural change is to do it through collaboration, through the political realm, through the legislature. But if ultimately that doesn't work and change still needs to be sought, then I would say there's no other means than to go through the court.
Yeah, well, and I think it's Jacksonville. I could be wrong on what city it is, but they have all the exclusion zones.
Yeah.
And the only way you can get from one point to another point is by helicopter without breaking the law.
Yeah.
That's litigation, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, and I find that those types of rules, those types of laws that make absolutely no sense, those generally get passed by politicians that really don't pay attention to research and really don't pay attention
to... Well, the ordinances, the county and city ordinances.
Yep. And so what I found for the groups that have gone the litigation route, it's generally in those types of situations where there's smaller municipalities that are trying to implement more stringent laws than the state's requiring, or their own laws and the state doesn't have one. And they make no sense, that's where it seems that litigation is less costly on some level than other forms of litigation, but it seems like that's where it's being used most by the groups.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking the question, David.
And then, Aaron, I'll just point you to the chat. Someone posted the Illinois group email info@ilvoices.com, so you could get in touch with them.
Great.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, I'll definitely be sending you along a list of other contacts that we have for some of those other states, because shame on them for not responding to
Well,
you just had a bad email.
I did get quite a few bounce back. I tried to make sure I typed them in correctly, but it could be on quite likely it's on my end.
If you had it from 2011, a lot of them had changed. So,
correct. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That kind of thing. Oh. So, yeah.
We've got somebody else popped on.
All right.
On the queue. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, maybe they don't want to go ahead.
Let me see. Oop, I think I just took them out of the queue. So if I took you out of the queue, I'm sorry. Pop back in.
All right. I will go ahead and at least partially announce that we do have a location for our...
Try that again.
Oh, there you are.
I'm sorry. That was my mistake. I was muted here and didn't realize it. You said shame on us for not contacting or participating. I want you to know that I have already started an email to Erin, so she has South Carolina contact.
There you go.
I was typing it as that discussion went on.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Don. I appreciate that.
And Don is one of our newer contacts in the state, so you probably would not have had his information.
Right.
So he needs not be ashamed. He would.
I was just going to say, no intent of public shaming. That was not the cause.
All right, but I am thinking of a couple of other longer-term, I do have a couple of other longer-term folks that I'm pretty sure probably just dropped the ball, but Don's not one of them. For sure. Yeah, great. Well, glad you're doing that, Don. Anyway, I was going to say that the conference for this coming year will be in Georgia, in Atlanta, Georgia, and it will be at the end of September. I don't have dates for sure because we're still firming that up, but keep those last couple of weekends in, I think that's when it's going to be, the last couple of weekends in September open, and be looking at pathways to Atlanta, Georgia at about that time, because that's and I hope we'll be getting something out pretty soon with a save the date on it.
Great.
We're still getting that finalized, so you can be the first to know roughly when and where. So
yeah, and I do plan to attend this year. I couldn't the last 2 years because you saw the baby on my screen before I opened this up. He's
right.
Not too fond of me leaving, but now he's getting to a point where I'm traveling, so I plan to be there next year.
Wonderful, that's great. You might have 2015 stuff ready to go a little bit.
And there's not anybody else in the queue.
Okay, and if that's the case, I think we can go ahead and wrap things up. Again, I want to thank Aaron for coming and all of you for being on the call, and look forward to being back next month. Next month is a holiday month, as in is December, and you will take note that Advancing Advocacy will be on the third Tuesdays of those 2 months, so they'll be a week earlier. Otherwise, we'll be trying to do it right smack dab on top of Thanksgiving and Christmas. So you can mark your calendars for the third Tuesdays for those, and go and sign up, because we've already got some great guests lined up for those too. So, am I still on?
You are still on, and I turned everybody else back.
Yeah, for a minute there I said I was muted. I thought I'm going to do a wall.
I meant to unmute everybody, yep. Brenda. So I was trying
to.
Yeah,
you did. Yeah, we're good, I think. So thanks, thank you all for coming. You're welcome to, we can say our farewells as we hang up, and thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Very good.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Good night.
Good night. Good
night,
everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Grumpy Granny, Great Big Fanny.
Toxic elements. So I'll tell you what, you couldn't be in a better spot building all of the businesses.